Chapter 7
"This is completely crazy," stormed Norden, looking like a berserk Viking chief. "There must be some explanation. Good heavens, there aren't any proper docking facilities on Deimos. How do they expect us to unload? I'm going to call the chief executive and raise hell."
"I shouldn't if I were you," drawled Bradley. "Did you notice the signature? This isn't an instruction from Earth routed through Mars. It originated in the CE's office. The old man may be a Tartar, but he doesn't do things unless he's got a good reason."
"Name just one."
Bradley shrugged his shoulders. "I don't have to run Mars, so how would I know? We'll find out soon enough." He gave a malicious little chuckle. "I wonder how Mac is going to take it. He'll have to recompute our approach orbit." Norden leaned across the control panel and threw a switch.
"Hello, Mac. Skipper here. You receiving me?"
There was a short pause, then Hilton's voice came from the speaker. "Mac's not here at the moment. Any message?"
"All right, you can break it to him. We've had orders from Mars to reroute the ship. They've diverted us from Phobos. No reason given at all. Tell Mac to calculate an orbit to Deimos, and to let me have it as soon as he can."
"I don't understand it. Why, Deimos is just a lot of mountains with no—"
"Yes, we've been through all that. Maybe we'll know the answer when we get there. Tell Mac to contact me as soon as he can, will you?"
Dr. Scott broke the news to Gibson while the author was putting the final touches to one of his weekly articles.
"Heard the latest?" he exclaimed breathlessly. "We've been diverted to Deimos. Skipper's mad as hell. It may make us a day late."
"Does anyone know why?"
"No, it's a complete mystery. We've asked, but Mars won't tell."
Gibson scratched his head, examining and rejecting half a dozen ideas. He knew that Phobos, the inner moon, had been used as a base ever since the first expedition had reached Mars, only 6,000 kilometers from the surface of the planet, and with a gravity less than a thousandth of Earth's, it was ideal for this purpose. The Ares was due to dock in less than a week, and already Mars was a small disk showing numerous surface markings even to the naked eye. Gibson had borrowed a large Mercator projection of the planet and had begun to learn the names of his chief features, names that had been given, most of them, more than a century ago by astronomers who had certainly never dreamed that men would one day use them as part of their normal lives. How poetical those old map-makers had been when they had ransacked mythology. Even to look at those words on the map was to set the blood pounding in the veins. Deucalion, Elysium, Eumenides, Arcadia, Atlantis, Utopia, Eos. Gibson could sit for hours fondling those wonderful names with his tongue, feeling as if in truth Keats's charmed magic casements were opening before him. But there were no seas, perilous or otherwise, on Mars, though many of its lands were sufficiently forlorn. The path of the Ares was now cutting steeply across the planet's orbit, and in a few days the motors would be checking the ship's outward speed. The change of velocity needed to deflect the voyage orbit from Phobos to Deimos was trivial, though it had involved Mackay in several hours of computing. Every meal was devoted to discussing one thing, the crew's plans when Mars was reached. Gibson's could be summed up in one phrase, to see as much as possible. It was perhaps a little optimistic to imagine that one could get to know a whole planet in 2 months, despite Bradley's repeated assurances that 2 days was quite long enough for Mars. The excitement of the voyage's approaching end had, to some extent, taken Gibson's mind away from his personal problems. He met Jimmy perhaps half a dozen times a day at meals and during accidental encounters, but they had not reopened their earlier conversation. For a while, Gibson suspected that Jimmy was deliberately avoiding him, but he soon realized that this was not altogether the case. Like the rest of the crew, Jimmy was very busy preparing for the end of the voyage. Norden was determined to have the ship in perfect condition when she docked, and a vast amount of checking and servicing was in progress. Yet despite this activity, Jimmy had given a good deal of thought to what Gibson had told him. At first he had felt bitter and angry towards the man who had been responsible, however unintentionally, for his mother's unhappiness. But after a while, he began to see Gibson's point of view and understood a little of the other's feelings. Jimmy was shrewd enough to guess that Gibson had not only left a good deal untold, but had put his own case as favorably as possible. Even allowing for this, however, it was obvious that Gibson genuinely regretted the past and was anxious to undo whatever damage he could, even though he was a generation late. It was strange to feel the sensation of returning weight and to hear the distant roar of the motors once again as the Ares reduced her speed to match the far smaller velocity of Mars. The maneuvering and the final delicate course corrections took more than 24 hours. When it was over, Mars was a dozen times as large as the full moon from Earth, with Phobos and Deimos visible as tiny stars whose movements could be clearly seen after a few minutes of observation. Gibson had never really realized how red the great deserts were, but the simple word red conveyed no idea of the variety of color on that slowly expanding disk. Some regions were almost scarlet, others yellow-brown, while perhaps the commonest hue was what could best be described as powdered brick. It was late spring in the southern hemisphere, and the polar cap had dwindled to a few glittering specks of whiteness where the snow still lingered stubbornly on higher ground. The broad belt of vegetation between pole and desert was for the greater part a pale bluish-green, but every imaginable shade of color could be found somewhere on that mottled disk. The Ares was swimming into the orbit of Deimos at a relative speed of less than 1,000 kilometers an hour. Ahead of the ship, the tiny moon was already showing a visible disk, and as the hours passed it grew until, from a few 100 kilometers away, it looked as large as Mars. But what a contrast it presented! Here were no rich reds and greens, only a dark chaos of jumbled rocks, of mountains which jutted up towards the stars at all angles in this world of practically zero gravity. Slowly the cruel rocks slid closer and swept past them, as the Ares cautiously felt her way down towards the radio beacon which Gibson had heard calling days before. Presently he saw, on an almost level area a few kilometers below, the first signs that man had ever visited this barren world. Two rows of vertical pillars jutted up from the ground, and between them was slung a network of cables. Almost imperceptibly, the Ares sank towards Deimos. The main rockets had long since been silenced, for the small auxiliary jets had no difficulty in handling the ship's effective weight of a few 100 kilograms. It was impossible to tell the moment of contact. Only the sudden silence when the jets were cut off told Gibson that the journey was over, and the Ares was now resting in the cradle that had been prepared for her. He was still, of course, 20,000 kilometers from Mars, and would not actually reach the planet itself for another day in one of the little rockets that were already climbing up to meet them. But as far as the Ares was concerned, the voyage was ended. The tiny cabin that had been his home for so many weeks would soon know him no more. He left the observation deck and hurried up to the control room, which he had deliberately avoided during the last busy hours. It was no longer so easy to move around inside the Ares, for the minute gravitational field of Deimos was just sufficient to upset his instinctive movements, and he had to make a conscious allowance for it. He wondered just what it would be like to experience a real gravitational field again. It was hard to believe that only 3 months ago, the idea of having no gravity at all had seemed very strange and unsettling, yet now he had come to regard it as normal. How adaptable the human body was! The entire crew was sitting round the chart table, looking very smug and self-satisfied. "You're just in time, Martin," said Norden cheerfully. "We're going to have a little celebration. Go and get your camera and take our pictures while we toast the old crate's health." "Don't drink at all before I come back," warned Gibson, and departed in search of his Leica. When he re-entered, Dr. Scott was attempting an interesting experiment. "I'm fed up with squirting my beer out of a bulb," he explained. "I want to pour it properly into a glass now we've got the chance again. Let's see how long it takes." "It'll be flat before it gets there," warned Mackay. "Let's see. Geez, about 0.5 centimeter a second squared. You're pouring from a height of..." He retired into a brown study. But the experiment was already in progress. Scott was holding the punctured beer tin about a foot above his glass, and, for the first time in 3 months, the word above had some meaning, even if very little. for with incredible slowness the amber liquid oozed out of the tin, so slowly that one might have taken it for syrup. A thin column extended downwards, moving almost imperceptibly at first, but then slowly accelerating. It seemed an age before the glass was reached. Then a great cheer went up as contact was made, and the level of the liquid began to creep upwards.
"I calculate it should be 120 seconds to get there," Mackay's voice was heard to announce above the din.
"Then you'd better calculate again," retorted Scott. "That's 2 minutes, and it's already there."
"Nay," said Mackay, startled, and obviously realizing for the first time that the experiment was over. He rapidly rechecked his calculations, and suddenly brightened at discovering a misplaced decimal point.
"Silly of me! I never was any good at mental arithmetic. I meant 12 seconds, of course."
"And that's the man who got us to Mars," said someone in shocked amazement. "I'm going to walk back."
Nobody seemed inclined to repeat Scott's experiment, which, though interesting, was felt to have little practical value. Very soon, large amounts of liquid were being squirted out of bulbs in the normal manner, and the party began to get steadily more cheerful. Dr. Scott recited the whole of that saga of the spaceways, and a prodigious feat of memory it was, which paying passengers seldom encounter, and which begins, "It was the spaceship Venus." Gibson followed for some time the adventures of this all-too-appropriately named craft and its ingenious, though single-minded, crew. Then the atmosphere began to get too close for him, and he left to clear his head. Almost automatically, he made his way back to his favorite viewpoint on the observation deck. He had to anchor himself in it, lest the tiny but persistent pull of Deimos dislodge him. Mars, more than half full and slowly waxing, lay dead ahead. Down there the preparations to greet them would already be underway, and even at this moment the little rockets would be climbing invisibly towards Deimos to ferry them down. 14,000 kilometers below, but still 6,000 kilometers above Mars, Phobos was transiting the unlighted face of the planet, shining brilliantly against its star-eclipsing crescent. Just what was happening on that little moon, Gibson wondered half-heartedly. Oh, well, he'll find out soon enough. Meanwhile, he'd polish up his aerography. Let's see, there was the double fork of the Sinus Meridiani, very convenient that, smack on the equator and in zero longitude, and over to the east was the Syrtis Major. Working from these two obvious landmarks, he could fill in the finer detail. Margaritifer Sinus was showing up nicely today, but there was a lot of cloud over Xanthi, and...
"Mr. Gibson!"
He looked round, startled.
"Why, Jimmy, you had enough to."
Jimmy was looking rather hot and flushed, obviously another seeker after fresh air. He wavered, a little unsteadily, into the observation seat, and for a moment stared silently at Mars, as if he'd never seen it before. Then he shook his head disapprovingly.
"It's awfully big," he announced to no one in particular.
"It isn't as big as Earth," Gibson protested. "And in any case, your criticism's completely meaningless, unless you state what standards you're applying. Just what size do you think Mars should be, anyway?"
This obviously hadn't occurred to Jimmy, and he pondered it deeply for some time.
"I don't know," he said sadly, "but it's still too big. Everything's too big."
This conversation was going to get nowhere, Gibson decided. He would have to change the subject.
"What are you going to do when you get down to Mars? You've got a couple of months to play with before the Ares goes home."
"Well, I suppose I'll wander around Port Lowell and go out and look at the deserts. I'd like to do a bit of exploring if I can manage it."
Gibson thought this quite an interesting idea, but he knew that to explore Mars on any useful scale was not an easy undertaking and required a good deal of equipment as well as experienced guides. It was hardly likely that Jimmy could attach himself to one of the scientific parties which left the settlements from time to time.
"I've an idea," he said. "They're supposed to show me everything I want to see. Maybe I can organize some trips out into Hellas or Hesperia, where no one's been yet. Would you like to come? We might meet some Martians."
That, of course, had been the stock joke about Mars ever since the first ships had returned with the disappointing news that there weren't any Martians after all. Quite a number of people still hoped, against all evidence, that there might be intelligent life somewhere in the many unexplored regions of the planet.
Yes, said Jimmy. That would be a great idea.
No one can stop me anyway. My time's my own as soon as we get to Mars. It says so in the contract.
He spoke this rather belligerently, as if for the information of any superior officers who might be listening, and Gibson thought it wisest to remain silent. The silence lasted for some minutes. Then Jimmy began, very slowly, to drift out of the observation port and to slide down the sloping walls of the ship. Gibson caught him before he had traveled very far and fastened two of the elastic handholds to his clothing, on the principle that Jimmy could sleep here just as comfortably as anywhere else. He was certainly much too tired to carry him to his bunk.
"Is it true that we only look at our true selves when we are asleep?" wondered Gibson. Jimmy seemed very peaceful and contented now that he was completely relaxed, although perhaps the ruby light from the great planet above gave him his appearance of well-being. Gibson hoped it was not all illusion. The fact that Jimmy had at last deliberately sought him out was significant. True, Jimmy was not altogether himself, and he might have forgotten the whole incident by morning, but Gibson did not think so. Jimmy had decided, perhaps not yet consciously, to give him another chance. He was on probation. Gibson awoke the next day with the most infernal din ringing in his ears. It sounded as if the Ares was falling to pieces around him, and he hastily dressed and hurried out into the corridor. The first person he met was Mackay, who didn't stop to explain, but shouted after him as he went by, "The rockets are here! The first one's going down in 2 hours. Better hurry. You're supposed to be on it." Gibson scratched his head a little sheepishly. "Someone ought to have told me," he grumbled. Then he remembered that someone had, so he'd only himself to blame. He hurried back to his cabin and began to throw his property into suitcases. From time to time, the Ares gave a distinct shudder around him, and he wondered just what was going on. Norden, looking rather harassed, met him at the airlock. Dr. Scott, also dressed for departure, was with him. He was carrying, with extreme care, a bulky metal case. "Hope you two have a nice trip down," said Norden. "We'll be seeing you in a couple of days, when we've got the cargo out. So until then... Oh, I almost forgot. I'm supposed to get you to sign this." "What is it?" asked Gibson suspiciously. "I never sign anything until my agents vetted it."
"Read it and see," grinned Norden. "It's quite an historic document." The parchment which Norden had handed him bore these words: "This is to certify that Martin M. Gibson, author, was the first passenger to travel in the liner Ares of Earth on her maiden voyage from Earth to Mars." Then followed the date and space for the signatures of Gibson and the rest of the crew. Gibson wrote his autograph with a flourish.
"I suppose this will end up in the Museum of Astronautics when they decide where they're going to build it," he remarked.
"So will the Ares, I expect," said Scott.
"That's a fine thing to say at the end of her first trip," protested Norden. "But I guess you're right. Well, I must be off. The others are outside in their suits. Shout to them as you go across. See you on Mars."
For the second time, Gibson climbed into a spacesuit, now feeling quite a veteran at this sort of thing. "Of course you'll understand," explained Scott, "that when the service is properly organized, the passengers will go across to the ferry through a connecting tube. That will cut out all this business."
"They'll miss a lot of fun," Gibson replied as he quickly checked the gauges on the little panel beneath his chin.
The outer door opened before them, and they jetted themselves slowly out across the surface of Deimos. The Ares, supported in the cradle of ropes, which must have been hastily prepared within the last week, looked as if a wrecking party had been at work on her. Gibson understood now the cause of the bangings and thumpings that had awakened him. Most of the plating from the southern hemisphere had been removed to get at the hold, and the space-suited members of the crew were bringing out the cargo, which was now being piled on the rocks around the ship. It looked, Gibson thought, a very haphazard sort of operation. He hoped that no one would accidentally give his luggage a push which would send it off irretrievably into space to become a third and still tinier satellite of Mars. Lying 50 meters from the Ares and quite dwarfed by her bulk were the two winged rockets that had come up from Mars during the night. One was already having cargo ferried into it. The other, a much smaller vessel, was obviously intended for passengers only. As Gibson slowly and cautiously followed Scott towards it, he switched over to the general wavelength of his suit and called goodbye to his crewmates. Their envious replies came back promptly, interspersed with much puffing and blowing, for the loads they were shifting, though practically weightless, possessed their normal inertia, and so were just as hard to set moving as on Earth.
"That's right," came Bradley's voice. "Leave us to do all the work."
"You've won compensation," laughed Gibson. "You must be the highest-paid stevedores in the solar system."
He could sympathize with Bradley's point of view. This was not the sort of work for which the highly trained technicians of the Ares had signed on. But the mysterious diversion of the ship from the tiny, though well-equipped port on Phobos had made such improvisations unavoidable. One couldn't very well make individual goodbyes on open circuit with half a dozen people listening, and in any case Gibson would be seeing everyone again in a few days. He would like to have had an extra word with Jimmy, but that would have to wait. It was quite an experience seeing a new human face again. The rocket pilot came into the airlock to help them with their suits, which were gently deposited back on Deimos for future use simply by opening the outer door again and letting the air current do the rest. Then he led them into the tiny cabin and told them to relax in the padded seats.
"Since you've had no gravity for a couple of months," he said, "I'm taking you down as gently as I can. I won't use more than a normal Earth gravity, but even that may make you feel as if you weigh a ton. Ready?"
"Yes," said Gibson, trying valiantly to forget his last experience of this nature. There was a gentle, faraway roar, and something thrust him firmly down into the depths of his seat. The crags and mountains of Deimos sank swiftly behind. He caught a last glimpse of the Ares, a bright silver dumbbell against that nightmare jumble of rocks. Only a second's burst of power had liberated them from the tiny moon. They were now floating round Mars in a free orbit. For several minutes, the pilot studied his instruments, receiving radio checks from the planet beneath and swinging the ship round its gyros. Then he punched the firing key again, and the rockets thundered for a few seconds more. The ship had broken free from the orbit of Deimos and was falling towards Mars. The whole operation was an exact replica, in miniature, of a true interplanetary voyage. Only the times and durations were changed. It would take them 3 hours, not months, to reach their goal, and they had only thousands instead of millions of kilometers to travel. "Well," said the pilot, locking his controls and swinging round in his seat, "had a good trip?"
"Quite pleasant, thanks," said Gibson. "Not much excitement, of course. Everything went very smoothly."
"How's Mars these days?" asked Scott.
"Oh, just the same as usual. All work and not much play. The big thing at the moment is the new dome we're building at Lowell. 300 meters, clear span. You'll be able to think you're back on Earth. We're wondering if we can arrange clouds and rain inside it."
"What's all this Phobos business?" said Gibson with a nose for news. "It caused us a lot of trouble."
"Oh, I don't think it's anything important. No one seems to know exactly. But there are quite a lot of people up there building a big lab. My guess is that Phobos is going to be a pure research station, and they don't want liners coming and going and messing up their instruments with just about every form of radiation known to science."
Gibson felt disappointed at the collapse of several interesting theories. Perhaps if he had not been so intent on the approaching planet, he might have considered this explanation a little more critically, but for the moment it satisfied him, and he gave the matter no further thought. When Mars seemed in no great hurry to come closer, Gibson decided to learn all he could about the practical details of life on the planet, now that he had a genuine colonist to question. He had a morbid fear of making a fool of himself, either by ignorance or tactlessness, and for the next couple of hours the pilot was kept busy alternating between Gibson and his instruments. Mars was less than 1,000 kilometers away when Gibson released his victim and devoted his whole attention to the expanding landscape beneath. They were passing swiftly over the equator, coming down into the outer fringes of the planet's extremely deep yet very tenuous atmosphere. Presently, and it was impossible to tell when the moment arrived, Mars ceased to be a planet floating in space and became instead a landscape far below. Deserts and oases fled beneath. The Syrtis Major came and passed before Gibson had time to recognize it. They were 50 kilometers up when there came the first hint that the air was thickening around them. A faint and distant sighing, seeming to come from nowhere, began to fill the cabin. The thin air was tugging at their hurtling projectile with feeble fingers, but its strength would grow swiftly, too swiftly if their navigation had been at fault. Gibson could feel the deceleration mounting as the ship slackened its speed. The whistle of air was now so loud, even through the insulation of the walls, that normal speech would have been difficult. This seemed to last for a very long time, though it could only have been a few minutes. At last, the wail of the wind died slowly away. The rocket had shed all its surplus speed against air resistance. The refractory material of its nose and knife-edged wings would be swiftly cooling from cherry red. No longer a spaceship now, but simply a high-speed glider, the little ship was racing across the desert at less than 1,000 kilometers an hour, riding down the radio beam into Port Lowell. Gibson first glimpsed the settlement as a tiny white patch on the horizon, against the dark background of the Aurora Sinus. The pilot swung the ship round in a great whistling arc to the south, losing altitude and shedding his surplus speed. As the rocket banked, Gibson had a momentary picture of half a dozen large circular domes clustered closely together. Then the ground was rushing up to meet him. There was a series of gentle bumps, and the machine rolled slowly to a standstill. He was on Mars. He had reached what to ancient man had been a moving red light among the stars, what to the men of only a century ago had been a mysterious and utterly unattainable world, and what was now the frontier of the human race.
"There's quite a reception committee," remarked the pilot. "All the transport fleets come out to see us. I didn't know they had so many vehicles serviceable."
Two small, squat machines with very wide balloon tires had come racing up to meet them. Each had a pressurized driving cab, large enough to hold two people, but a dozen passengers had managed to crowd onto the little vehicles by grabbing convenient handholds. Behind them came two large half-tracked buses, also full of spectators. Gibson had not expected quite such a crowd, and began to compose a short speech.
"I don't suppose you know how to use these things yet," said the pilot, producing two breathing masks, "but you've only got to wear them for a minute while you get over to the fleas."
"The what?" thought Gibson. "Oh, of course. Those little vehicles would be the famous Martian sand fleas, the planet's universal transports."
"I'll fix them on for you. Oxygen okay? Right, here we go. It may feel a bit queer at first."
The air slowly hissed from the cabin until the pressure inside and out had been equalized. Gibson felt his exposed skin tingling uncomfortably. The atmosphere around him was now thinner than above the peak of Everest. It had taken 3 months of slow acclimatization on the Ares and all the resources of modern medical science to enable him to step out on the surface of Mars with no more protection than a simple oxygen mask. It was flattering that so many people had come to meet him. Of course, it wasn't often that Mars could expect so distinguished a visitor, but he knew that the busy little colony had no time for ceremonial. Dr. Scott emerged beside him, still carrying the large metal case he had nursed so carefully through the whole of the trip. At his appearance, a group of the colonists came rushing forward, completely ignored Gibson, and crowded round Scott. Gibson could hear their voices, so distorted in this thin air as to be almost incomprehensible.
"Glad to see you again, Doc. Here, let us carry it."
"We've got everything ready, and there are 10 cases waiting in hospital now. We should know how good it is in a week."
"Come on, get into the bus and talk later."
Before Gibson had realized what was happening, Scott and his impedimenta had been swept away. There was a shrill whine of a powerful motor, and the bus tore off towards Port Lowell, leaving Gibson feeling as foolish as he had ever been in his life. He had completely forgotten the serum. To Mars, its arrival was of infinitely greater importance than a visit by any novelist, however distinguished he might be on his own planet. it was a lesson he would not forget in a hurry. Luckily, he had not been completely deserted. The sand fleas were still left. One of the passengers disembarked and hurried up to him.
"Mr. Gibson, I'm Westerman of the Times. The Martian Times, that is. Very pleased to meet you. This is—"
"Henderson, in charge of port facilities," interrupted a tall, hatchet-faced man, obviously annoyed that the other had got in first. "I've seen that your luggage will be collected. Jump aboard." It was quite obvious that Westerman would have much preferred Gibson as his own passenger, but he was forced to submit with as good grace as he could manage. Gibson climbed into Henderson's flea through the flexible plastic bag that was the vehicle's simple but effective airlock, and the other joined him a minute later in the driving cab. It was a relief to discard the breathing mask. The few minutes he had spent in the open had been quite a strain. He also felt very heavy and sluggish, the exact reverse of the sensation one would have expected on reaching Mars. But for 3 months he had known no gravity at all, and it would take him some time to grow accustomed to even a third of his terrestrial weight. The vehicle began to race across the landing strip towards the domes of the port, a couple of kilometers away. For the first time, Gibson noticed that all around him was the brilliant mottled green of the hardy plants that were the commonest life form on Mars. Overhead, the sky was no longer jet black, but a deep and glorious blue. The sun was not far from the zenith, and its rays struck with surprising warmth through the plastic dome of the cabin. Gibson peered at the dark vault of the sky, trying to locate the tiny moon on which his companions were still at work. Henderson noticed his gaze, took one hand off the steering wheel, and pointed close to the sun. "There she is," he said. Gibson shielded his eyes and stared into the sky. Then he saw, hanging like a distant electric arc against the blue, a brilliant star a little westwards of the sun. It was far too small, even for Deimos, but it was a moment before Gibson realized that his companion had mistaken the object of his search. That steady, unwinking light, burning so unexpectedly in the daylight sky, was now, and would remain for many weeks, the morning star of Mars. But it was better known as Earth.